Okay, so switching gears a little bit to some of the qualitative findings from my dissertation. I used multiple sources of data to kind of explain some of these broader quantitative findings by looking at perceptions and experiences of HIV testing among young people in Malawi. No relationships. So in 2009, Caroline chats with a 23-year-old married woman named Ruth about her relationship history with her current husband. The conversation transitions into a discussion of Ruth's past experience with HIV testing. And Caroline asks her, "So when you went for testing, did you tell your husband or did you just go?" And Ruth responds, "I told him there was no reason to be afraid, but he refused." So Caroline asks Ruth if she gave up trying or if she continues to plead with her husband, and she responded, "No, I didn't give up. I always tell him to go for testing. The first time I went, I told him that you should also go so we have proof that we're all right. But if you don't, then I'll be having doubts. Maybe my husband's positive or negative. I won't be sure. The second time I went, I told him the same, but to no avail. He says that he can't go and that those who go for testing are doubting themselves. They don't trust themselves. It pains me that he's not helping me and the children." Now, I present Ruth's narrative not to illustrate women's vulnerability here, but instead to show her tremendous agency to plead with her husband to get tested. Ruth's narrative illustrates one of the many different ways that husbands and wives negotiate testing with each other. In contrast to Ruth, not all Malawian women are as forthcoming and persistent with their partners, nor are all Malawian men refusing to test. However, what unites some of these narratives that I found was this underlying theme of trust. So again, we know that HIV testing is an important entry point to care, treatment, and prevention. Rates of testing are less than ideal, and many different demographic, psychosocial, and structural factors are thought to influence this. Less research has focused on the relationship level, despite the fact that these decisions are made in a broader social context. Catherine Ryan talks about how an HIV test is not simply a tool to measure immunological malfunction, but rather it illustrates a set of broader social facts. And so she suggests that the virtues and fears embedded in the act of testing are related to larger questions of how families and relationships might change in light of a positive test result. Other qualitative research has shown that test results have deeper meanings that are tied to relationships, faithfulness, and trust. And so this study seeks to provide context to the quantitative studies on relationship factors that influence these testing decisions. For example, what does it mean to get tested for HIV within the context of relationship? Does an HIV test carry different meanings depending on the status of the relationship? And what does this mean for public health? So these questions were asked of young people. And young people are really important to study because they're going through these numerous life transitions as they get married, bear children, and navigate the terms of their relationships. So this study was also conducted in the same region in the southern district of Balaka in Malawi. The southern district has a 15% prevalence rate for HIV. Most women have been tested, and about half of men have ever tested. So I draw upon two sources of qualitative data collected in 2009 and 2011. In 2009, I conducted 34 semi-structured interviews with young, coupled men and women. So we interviewed partners, but we did it separately but simultaneously so they couldn't talk in between the interviews and bias the results. Respondents were asked to share their experiences with testing but not their test results, and to explain how decisions were made and how their relationship may have changed in light of testing. The results presented today are mostly going to focus on the focus group data collected in 2011 among 62 young men and women. I stratified the focus groups on marital status and relationships, marital status and gender, in order to make respondents feel more comfortable. And perceptions of testing were elicited with a series of vignettes that presented this hypothetical couple named Lucy and Promise, who were getting married and starting to make decisions about HIV testing. For example, one of the scenarios would ask, you know, Lucy is worried that her partner is cheating on her, she wants to go for testing, what should she do, and so forth. For both sets of data, the sample was between the ages of 16 and 25, both married and dating, and were recruited from three sites in the Balaka district. So this slide gives you an idea of the three distinct settings where these focus group discussions took place. Setting number one was in the block of town, and we conducted focus groups at a teacher development center. The second site was a rural trading center village, and we were able to utilize an immunization clinic located in the middle of a field, basically. And then the third site was a more rural, isolated farming community. So the results show that three interconnected themes that frame the analysis. The idea that the timing of testing matters, the incompatibility of testing with marriage, and the various workaround strategies that couples use to kind of overcome these issues regarding conflict and trust when getting tested. So respondents from six of the eight focus groups mentioned that it's ideal to go for testing before marriage. In other words, in their ideal relationship sequence, HIV testing should come, then sex, then marriage, then childbearing. And so respondents provided a variety of different reasons for why you need to go while you're in the courtship phase of the relationship. For example, it's best to go when falling in love, since sex will probably follow in order to prevent transmission. To determine if a chibwenzi, which is the boyfriend or girlfriend, is marriage material. Testing also signified trustworthiness and dedication to the relationship. And finally, some of the men talked about how testing could be used to convince a reluctant partner to have sex. So note that while, of course, HIV prevention was an important underlying goal of testing, for many rural Malawians, the importance of testing was also related to future aspirations around marriage and childbearing, love and intimacy, and part of a decision to take a relationship to the next level. However, ideal relationship sequences are not always possible and can lead to a complicated web of love, sex, and HIV. So in this focus group discussion of single men, Stephen points out that a good relationship is one where you have proposed each other and you go for testing. If you're really in love, you can have sex, but it's better to go after testing. That's a good courtship. Joseph says, my idea isn't the same. You should start sleeping with each other after you have gone for testing. And Stephen replies, but you may want to have sex with the woman before we know our status. And Andrew chimes in, it's possible that the woman had sex with someone who's positive and she didn't go for testing. But maybe you went and you're found okay, meaning HIV negative. But now you're caught in the cobweb and then you're found in the group of being infected. So this is why individual testing has its benefits, but really you need to go together as a couple at the beginning of the relationship. And so HIV testing was deemed more appropriate during courtship than during marriage because it allowed a couple to establish a new relationship pattern or relationship norm, if you will. So when they go for testing, it won't be a surprise. In this focus group discussion, a single man says, testing has to start while dating. You have to tell each other to go for testing while dating, not just when you're married. Because if you do, you might start having doubts about your partner. For example, why all of a sudden does she want to go for testing? Has she been sleeping around with other men? And HIV testing also serves as a baseline assessment of status to use in future situations around infidelity. For example, in this discussion, John says, it goes wrong in the beginning because you did not take each other for testing. And Moses says, because we can think of the woman as a cheater when she is not. The problem is really based when you didn't go for testing. So while testing during marriage was considered a sign of a problem in the relationship and raise questions of faithfulness that may actually limit the uptake of testing. So in this quote, a married man says, testing just doesn't come up like, let's go for testing. No. When there's doubt in the house, for example, how is my partner moving, meaning behaving sexually? If I think she's cheating, that's when you go for testing. But if you're trusting each other, even if people say that they're getting tested over there at the VCT clinic, you don't consider it. And refusing to test carries the same negative connotations associated with guilt and promiscuity. However, this doesn't mean that rural Malawians don't see the value in getting tested. Respondents explained that ideally married couples should get tested together because they're a couple. They share the same issue and they're considered one. Some of the perceived benefits of testing together, for example, through couples VCT, was that the act of testing symbolizes love, unity, and a strong marriage. It could also be used to avoid a situation of deception, since partners were told their status together, and this came up multiple times during the interviews about how people just really didn't trust when their partner got tested, and they didn't really know what the result was. So they would often ask to see the test slip when they came home. And also, it helps to avoid one couple member being labeled as the cheater if they tested individually, even if the other couple member did not know their status. Other strategies to overcome testing barriers included withholding sex, particularly when dating, going for testing alone first, learning one's status, and then pretending as if you didn't test and coming up to your partner and proposing to go for testing. And then men actually showed a lot of support for antenatal care testing because they were recruited through an authority figure, which was the healthcare worker instead of their wife. So an HIV test doesn't simply provide a medical diagnosis. Instead, Rome allowings construct meaning around the act of testing and the test result itself within the context of their everyday relationships. An HIV test becomes a symbol of something larger, perhaps more important to some people. It becomes a marker of their relationship status rather than just their HIV serostatus. So testing was used to advance a new relationship, to determine whether to have children and with whom, and to evaluate a spouse's faithfulness. So married couples face really difficult decisions around testing during marriage. Bringing up testing, refusing to test, and the act of testing itself symbolizes an HIV infection, which underlines the whole premise of testing to begin with. So how can this information be translated into more effective testing programs? So given the dilemmas that married couples face, testing providers really need to consider these unique issues when offering tests as well as in their counseling messages with patients. The study also supports the need to shift from client-initiated testing to provider-initiated testing in Malawi, especially for married couples, so couples don't have to bring up these issues themselves. And finally, one-time test is not enough to prevent infection. HIV testing programs need to emphasize the importance of regular testing during marriage and should work to make this as easy as possible on couples so that they can get tested and learn their status regularly as they navigate these new risk pathways in their relationships. Again, I'd like to acknowledge my funding and my mentors. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to thank all of our speakers. Those are really very interesting studies. And I know there's a few of us in the room. I hate to be so formal and have everybody come up here, but because there sounds like there's a party in the other room, just so everyone can hear with the mic, I'm going to invite all the speakers to come up. And if you have questions, then we can ask them of our great panelists. Does anyone have a question to any particular speaker or a question for the entire panel? Yeah.
Sorry. How many are you? I know you can ask me this question.
No, no, ask now. It's good.
I was just thinking with the university, at the end of your time, the limitations of this study, you were talking about how Skid Row in Los Angeles may not be representative of a lot of homeless populations. How do you see that this sample in the larger study of homelessness? What kinds of homeless folks is this really telling us?
I'm going to ask you to just come to the mic just so we make sure that everyone can hear. Could everyone hear the question? It was about Skid Row and homelessness, and while we, you know, the qualitative data may not necessarily be generalizable to other homeless individuals, how does this study then fit into homeless individuals beyond Skid Row?
Well, so Eric and Haley and I work on research with homeless young people, particularly in Hollywood on the west side of Los Angeles. Under 25-year-old, and their context of homelessness is very different from the context of homelessness in the Skid Row area, which is many people sleeping out of doors in encampments, really the type of thing that you associate with visible homelessness. And I think that, in a way, that makes us a very marginalized population who maybe are experiencing lots of negative psychological and physical health consequences of being homeless. But in sort of a positive spin on that, Skid Row is also the area where there are all of these services. So you do have the ability to go into these organizations and try to talk about evidence-based interventions and testing programs and things like that. So I don't know that the same thing would work for, like, the youth that we work with, where it's more spread out and you can't sort of find everyone as easily. So positives and negatives for why this isn't representative. That's all.
I was just thinking when you were talking about screening for African American women, it reminded me of studies maybe 10 or more years ago about similar attitudes towards screening for breast cancer and other cancers. And I was just wondering how did that come up when you talked to people, or did you see literature on that and how that connects?
Yes, yeah. Some of them, yeah.
You know, that's a really interesting thought. It's sort of in my career trajectory. I actually started in cancer prevention and doing breast cancer prevention work with African American women. But I don't know if you often find people who have that balance between knowing about HIV risk and knowing about breast cancer, or in thinking about screening and reluctance to screening tests, specifically for diseases where people have strong feelings about what it would mean if you were diagnosed and what those outcomes would be. So that hasn't come up in discussions prior to now, but I think that you bring up a good point that could be something to think about as we move forward, looking at how things have changed in years with mammography and screening and acceptance of that, and thinking of how we can use that to encourage women with HIV testing, especially now as we're moving into a new phase in the United States where it really is becoming more of a chronic disease and you know, it's not a death sentence. And I think moving these communities to a place where they recognize that and understand and accept that would help.
Okay, other questions?
Yes.
Well, Dr. Angelou, I'm just wondering, because I mentioned that you're targeting some group of people for safety, obviously because of limitation and resources, but what it implies that obviously we have missed some individuals at baseline, because HIV is not sure the face, and also those tests positive and have implications for some other diseases.
Thank you, Bright, for that question. The ideal case would have been to test everybody, every available person. But, you know, sometimes it has to do with resources and the targets you're given. So you can only do what you are funded to do. And you know, when we started, we're testing the general population. But I said the group, the key indicators were how many people tested positive and were linked into care. So we were falling short in this, we weren't achieving much in the first 2 years, despite exceeding our testing target. So we now need to re-strategize based on the resources available for us and the target we're given, to ensure that we target group that are likely going to be positive. Of course, what you said is very important. We're equally working with the state government to ensure that they provide test kits so that we can extend testing to other groups and test everybody that comes to the hospitals. That would have been the ideal case, but resources and other limitations might not allow us to do that.
Other questions? I actually have to say, comment. I work in rural Appalachia, and so trying to get people to get tested in rural Appalachia, even though we're in the same country as some of our presenters here, and even, you know, compared to internationally, the percentage of people that have been tested is very, very, very small. So I'm very encouraged by the numbers in all of your presentations, because in my research and what I've worked with, we have very few people getting tested or even access to getting tested. So. This is at least encouraging. We have work to do where I am. Yes, ma'am.
I'm wondering,
HIV counseling and testing, there are a lot of protocols that you go through. There's a guideline that you have to follow. It's an opt-out approach. we offer counseling for everybody, even in PITC, provider initiated testing and counseling, everybody offer counseling, but they can either opt out or opt in for the testing. It's not mandatory that you test them. Even after collecting their blood samples, if they say they don't want to continue, you have to obey their, you have to just live by what they've said. But that said, we try as much as possible to encourage people to come for testing, but they are not, it's not compulsory that they do the testing. They are not legally bound to do the testing. So it's a guideline that we follow, it's a national guideline, which is adapted from the WHO national guideline. And then so people offer testing and they can either opt out or opt in for testing. Yeah, when you give the result, there's no written. In the past, in the time past, when the strategy started, they used to write results for people, but they found out that this was not getting us to where we should be, because what you see is that people that tested negative will carry the results, and some of them will even laminate it and go and paste it in their room that I'm HIV negative, forgetting that they might actually be at the window period. So now we give verbal results, and then there's no written consent, but people will just do verbal consent. Consent to it, there's no written.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, actually, I'm very excited about it. I can just speak from the, I have a study that we're going to be doing in rural Appalachia around the over-the-counter kits that you can buy, and looking to see whether or not people can understand how to use them and will use them compared to standard of care, which I just have to say, in my one county, which has 60,000 residents, we have one place that does HIV testing, which is Planned Parenthood, which obviously not everyone can get to. So everyone can get to Walmart and CVS, and or most people, although the cost is a little prohibitive to some of our folks that live near me. But anyway, yes, we're very excited about that, and I'm hoping next year the program chairs, we're going to certainly have some sessions devoted to the self-testing. So, anyone else want to have a CDC? Anyone want to respond?
No.
Sure.
No.
Yeah.
Anyone want? These opinions represent mine and may not be that of the CDC.
Okay. Right.
But I also would be interested to see, in the next year what happens. But I think one of the things we think about when we think about, I've presented on Black women at risk of HIV testing, and a lot of the populations that we deal with when we look at heterosexual epidemic in the United States tend to be people in lower economic situations and who also have a lot of stigma around HIV. So it'll be interesting to see that while these are available, what does it look like in communities and neighborhoods where you go to the drugstore and condoms are still locked up and pregnancy tests are still locked up, and then do you feel comfortable going into the pharmacy and saying, hey, can you unlock this because I want the HIV test? And then also the issues of the cost and whether or not that's prohibitive, and how sort of some of this will, I think within the first year, we'll be looking at and figuring out how that all works, and then as time goes on, how does that become more effective, and is this something that can be made available to those populations who really need it in a way that makes sense for them?
Any other comments on that? I mean, there's also ethical issues, I think, that go, there's a whole lot of stuff that's going to go along with the self-testing and then getting people into care, because, again, where we are, we don't have good care services, so then you get someone who's positive and they have other options besides telling people, et cetera. So anyway, next year, look for some of those, or in the coming years, studies related to that. Any other questions? Anybody? Any other final thoughts from anyone on our panel? No? Okay. Well, did you have your hand up? No. I'm going to start calling on people. Well, seeing that it's getting close to dinner and the HIV/AIDS social, so I'm just going to repeat that again. If you want to come to the Blue Restaurant from 7 to 9 tonight, free food. There'll be can't say free drinks, but there'll be some, you know, you can purchase. And lots of fun people in the HIV AIDS section. We're lots of fun. We like to party. So,
right, that's right.
We always have a good crowd. So please come join us regardless of your HIV AIDS primary or secondary affiliation. We'd love to have you come out. So thanks to everyone for coming. I'm sure our panelists can stick around for a couple minutes if you'd like to come up and ask them a question or introduce yourself. So thank you again, and safe travels to everybody trying to get home, especially those of us trying to get back toward the East Coast. So good luck,
and take care.
Thank you again to everyone.